Hello and welcome to this week's episode of NLDR, the Narrative Lectionary Podcast for People on the Go. I'm Dr. Robert Williamson, Associate Professor of Religious Studies at Hendricks College in Conway, Arkansas, and founding pastor of Mercy Community Church of Little Rock. I'm joined this and every week by my friend and colleague Dr. Amy Robertson, Executive Director of Congregation Bet Havrim in Atlanta. This week, the Narrative Lectionary finds us in the book of Ezra, chapters 1 and 3. The people are released from exile to return to Jerusalem, where they find the temple in ruins and the altar torn down. We discuss the importance of ritual in connecting the people with God and with each other, the mingling of joy and sorrow that attends to new beginnings, and the urgency of pressing ahead even when the situation seems overwhelming. Thanks for joining us. Hey, Amy, how are you this week?
I'm good, Bobby. How are you?
I'm doing really well. So this week, we are in Ezra chapter 1 a little tiny bit, and then chapter 3. Mm-hmm. So what kind of background do you think we ought to have about the book of Ezra?
So the book of Ezra begins sort of where Chronicles ends, at the end of the exile, and moves us sort of into the Second Temple period. And we'll, you know, read this week about the construction of the Second Temple. So we talked last time a little bit about historically what's going on. Babylon, who had first conquered Judah and sent a lot of Judeans into exile, Babylon has now been conquered by Persia. But many of the Judeans that were sent into exile are still in exile.
So just to place us historically, we're the first year of King Cyrus, which is 538 maybe or 537. The exile proper, the destruction of the temple, took place in 587, 586. And mm-hmm. So basically, it's been 50 years that the Jews have been in exile. So the people, and we'll see this becomes important in chapter 3, but many of the people who are returning are not the same people who were exiled. They are the children and maybe the grandchildren of mm-hmm. people who were exiled.
Yeah, 50 years is a long time.
Long time. Not as long as I used to think it was.
True story.
So, all right. We're going to read Ezra 1, verses 1 through 4, and I am reading from the New Revised Standard Version. In the first year of King Cyrus of Persia, in order that the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be accomplished, the Lord stirred up the spirit of King Cyrus of Persia so that he sent a herald throughout all his kingdom and also in a written edict declared, "Thus says King Cyrus of Persia, the Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has charged me to build him a house at Jerusalem in Judah. Any of those among you who are of his people, may their God be with them, are now permitted to go up to Jerusalem in Judah and rebuild the house of the Lord, the God of Israel. He is the God who is in Jerusalem. And let all survivors in whatever place they reside be assisted by the people of their place with silver and gold, with goods and with animals, besides freewill offerings for the house of God in Jerusalem." Okay, so this is the Persian king Cyrus basically declaring that the God of Israel has charged him with helping the Jews return and rebuild the temple in Jerusalem. What do you make of that charge that King Cyrus has?
I'm very interested in sort of King Cyrus's theology.
Yeah.
King Cyrus believes that the God of Israel has charged him with this task, right?
Yeah.
King Cyrus also refers to the God of Israel as the Lord God of heaven.
Right.
Although later uses some language that localizes the God of Israel a little bit more to being in Jerusalem.
Yeah.
So taking these three things together, I'm simply throwing your question back in your face.
Yeah. Tag, you're it.
Tag, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we've seen before Nebuchadnezzar has been used by God to do certain things. We saw last week in Isaiah 40 that Cyrus was called God's anointed one, mm-hmm. the Mashiach, who is going to set the Jews free from captivity. But what's interesting here is that, so this is the words of Cyrus claiming that he knows that God is the one who's given him this charge. And mm-hmm. that's different than what we've seen before. Before, it's been like these kings don't know that God is like working with them. Now, this is King Cyrus saying, yeah, like God gave me this task. Your God gave me this task. Now, to complicate that a little bit, this is a Hebrew Bible author who is putting words in King Cyrus's mouth, acknowledging that King Cyrus knows that it's the Hebrew God that is doing things. So, like, did Cyrus really say something like this? We don't actually know. But we do have evidence from the Cyrus cylinder and other cultures where Cyrus did claim, especially in the case of Babylon, Cyrus claimed that the Babylonian god Marduk had chosen him, Cyrus, to restore Marduk worship in Babylon. And so it's entirely plausible that Cyrus would have actually said something like this, although we don't have evidence of it other than here and in 2 Chronicles 36. But it's the kind of thing Cyrus would do. Now, that raises another question about whether Cyrus, you know, really thought that the God of Israel had commanded him to do this thing, or whether he found it politically expedient.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, from the perspective of the book of Ezra, this is a great thing. This is not a problematic thing at all that Cyrus is saying, hey, the God of Israel is the one who's declared this thing. The book of Ezra loves Cyrus. It loves the Persians. And it really does seem to think that Persia is acting on behalf of God to reestablish worship of Adonai, the God of Israel, in Jerusalem.
Is there anything we want to say about this citation of Jeremiah? So in the first verse, it says that all of this happening was fulfilling the word that was spoken by Jeremiah. Do you have a particular word of Jeremiah in mind when you read that?
You know, the thing that comes to my mind is Jeremiah 29, verse 10, mm-hmm. where it's an oracle. Thus says the Lord, only when Babylon's 70 years are completed will I visit you, and I will fulfill to you my promise and bring you back to this place.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Ezra is seeing in the Cyrus edict, is seeing this fulfillment of this promise that God's going to restore the people after 70 years. But it is interesting, and I know that you're going to like this part, that as much as Ezra wants to see continuity with things that came before, Ezra is decidedly not interested in the restoration of the Davidic monarchy.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to like that more than you did.
No, I do like it. I like it. I like it a lot.
That's going to be interesting. So if one is a Christian, especially a Christian preacher who is preaching this text during Advent, which is about anticipating the Davidic Messiah, Jesus, that is not the way that this text is going to connect to Advent. I'm not sure what the way is, but Ezra doesn't seem to have that kind of messianic expectation. He thinks this thing is happening with Cyrus, and so we're good.
Mm-hmm. Cyrus is the Messiah. I mean, is the anointed that's saving them in this text. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think Ezra actually uses that language.
I don't think Ezra does either.
But yeah, no. I think he's in line with 2nd Isaiah, who's writing it about this exact same time.
Yep.
Okay, so we're going to move then to chapter 3. The narrative lectionary is verses 1 through 4 and then verses 10 through 13. But there's something different happening in verses 1 through 7 than what is happening in verses 8 through 14. And so I feel like the way the narrative lectionary is constructed, it kind of merges two different events as though they are one big event. Mm-hmm. So to put it briefly, the first part of this text in 1 through 7 is set in the seventh month of the first year of Cyrus, I guess it is. And it's about the building of the altar and the restoration of sacrifice in Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the second part of the text is in the second year, in the second month. So we're, you know, basically 6 months later, and now they start to lay the foundation of the temple. So I think what I'm going to do just right now is read chapter 3, verses 1 through 5. When the seventh month came and the Israelites were in the towns, the people gathered together in Jerusalem. Then Jeshua, son of Jozadak, with his fellow priests, and Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, with his kin, set out to build the altar of the God of Israel, to offer burnt offerings on it, as prescribed in the law of Moses, the man of God. They set up the altar on its foundation because they were in dread of the neighboring peoples, and they offered burnt offerings upon it to the Lord, morning and evening. And they kept the festival of booths as prescribed, and offered the daily burnt offerings by number according to the ordinance as required for each day, and after that the regular burnt offerings, the offerings at the new moon and at all the sacred festivals of the Lord, and the offerings of everyone who made a free will offering to the Lord. Could you just talk a little bit about, like, why the urgency, do you think, about starting sacrifice before doing anything else?
I mean, I think at that time, sacrifice was seen as like the primary way of connecting and having communion with God. And so that was part of the horror of the temple being destroyed and the temple cult sort of ceasing to exist, was that they didn't have that sort of, you know, communication, but it's like, you know, sharing a meal. They didn't have a way to, that was their primary outlet for connecting to God ritually.
Yeah.
So it makes sense to me that before they go about building this whole magnificent structure, the first thing they're going to want is an altar, a simpler altar where they can make sacrifices. I do wonder at the sentence that says, because they were in fear of the people of the land.
But you figure, you know, the Jews have been gone for 50 years and Jerusalem has been in ruins.
Mm-hmm.
And so the people from around Jerusalem, like, suddenly I think probably found that they had become more important, right? Because the kind of urban center was no longer there. And so when the people come back with this edict from Cyrus, they see their power slipping away from them.
And so they give
a hard time to the returnees all the way from here, all the way down into the time of Ezra and Nehemiah 100 years later. We have an image of Nehemiah who they're rebuilding the wall of Jerusalem. And they're like stacking rocks with one hand and holding their spear in the other hand in case they get attacked while they're doing it. And so this is, until Jerusalem gets reestablished, there's this kind of tension between the people of the land and the people who've come back.
You know, there's a rabbinic text that points out that when in the book of Joshua, when the Israelites first went into the land, one of the first things they did also was to build an altar, which sort of draws this parallel of like, this is not a conquest, like it's not depicted as a conquest in Ezra and Nehemiah, but they're moving into a place where other people are and, you know, are reestablishing something. And, you know, it's sort of from their history and they have this edict, but for the people there, that's not such a win.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And that connection to Joshua is really interesting. When you go back to the book of Joshua and when the Israelites first cross into the land, the first thing they do is circumcise themselves, which is a terrible battle strategy. and then they celebrate the Passover. And so there's this sense like, a logical strategy would be, you know, cross the river, defeat the enemy armies, and then establish
right, and
worship.
Then set up your
then circumcise
worship.
Yourself. Yeah. And so you could also imagine with the returnees from exile, the thing to do would be to come back, rebuild the wall of Jerusalem, rebuild the temple, and then start sacrifices. And they're kind of doing it backwards of what you would expect, even though they seem to be afraid of the people. But they say the first thing is we've got to reestablish our relationship. I like the way you said that. We've got to reestablish our relationship with God through these sacrifices, because that's the thing on which everything else depends.
Right. That's the oxygen mask, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I like that. Yeah. On that issue of being afraid and building the altar first, you know, it seems to me like a lot of times we, like your tendency is often something like we can't do this thing until we have the perfect plan in place to do it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so here it's not that at all. It's a, you know, do the best you can with what you've got. If what you have right now is that you set the altar back up on its foundation, just out in the middle of the rubble, and you start sacrificing while you're being afraid, and that's what you can do, like, go do that thing, and then the rest will come.
Right. This is really sort of like where the rubber meets the road.
Yeah.
This is the reality of what it looks like. And it's a little dirty and there's gravel and you hold your spears while you build.
So is there anything that you would want to say about the specific offerings that are made here? The Festival of Booths, the daily burnt offerings. I'm just curious if there's anything in there that strikes you as somebody who thinks a little bit more about ritual and sacrifice than I do.
Well, I will say that at least in Second Chronicles, it is also during Tabernacle. The Festival of Booths is also the Festival of Tabernacles, which is the modern holiday, Sukkot. It's, you know, during that holiday is when the first temple is dedicated. All the particular sacrifices that they're mentioning here, what strikes me about it is it's not like a sin offering or a peace offering, or like these are sort of like prescribed offerings that sort of happen other than the free will ones at the end. they sort of like, they mark the time. They sort of maybe get the people back in touch with time and sort of the sacred time and relationship with God through sacred time. But they're not so much the impromptu such and such happened. And so now they're not as reactive.
That's really interesting. I love where you just went with that. And because I've been thinking about this in terms of establishing relationship, which I think is part of it. But those two observations that it's not about making amends, which is how mm-hmm. Christians often think about sacrifices as being necessarily about making amends, but they're not, and these aren't. But the way you were talking just there about like restarting time, I think that's really beautiful. Like the liturgical calendar, right? Like time has not been observed for mm-hmm. 50 years. And now you've got the seasons being observed. You've got the start and end of the day.
The morning and the evening, the
festivals, the new moon. Like it's very much focused on the calendar. So restoring a sense of normalcy to the mm-hmm. people and to the rhythms of life is the first thing. Like life has kind of restarted now. Mm-hmm. It's really nice. I like that.
Yeah. No, I like you said it better than I did. I like it.
I do that thing that I always do where I just say the thing that you said over again and talk about
it.
How awesome it was. Okay, so I'm in verse 6 now, reading through just 6 and 7. From the first day of the seventh month, they began to offer burnt offerings to the Lord, but the foundation of the temple of the Lord was not yet laid. So they gave money to the masons and the carpenters, and the food and drink and oil to the Sidonians and the Tyrians, to bring cedar from Lebanon to the sea, to Joppa, according to the grant that they had from King Cyrus of Persia. So to me, the most important thing there is just that notice in verse 6 that the foundation of the temple had not been laid.
Mm-hmm.
So they're doing these sacrifices, but the temple has not started to be reconstructed yet. That's the thing that's left. What else would you want to pull out of there?
I guess just, again, sort of the acknowledgement of the practicalities, like that they paid craftsmen and then they paid for their materials to come with food and drink and oil. And I mean, bringing cedar wood from Lebanon, that's a production.
Yeah, no, yes. They're trying to recreate this magnificent structure with the mm-hmm. finest materials. The only thing that I really want to note in this next little section, in verse 8 and 9, is just the time stamp. So in verse 8, in the second year after their arrival at the house of God at Jerusalem, in the second month, Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Jeshua, son of Jozadak, made a beginning, together with the rest of their people, the priests and the Levites, and all who had come to Jerusalem from captivity. So previously, we were in the seventh month of the first year. Now we're in mm-hmm. the second month of the second year. So if I'm doing my math correctly, that's been roughly 7 months.
Mm-hmm.
So picking up in the middle of verse 8, they appointed the Levites from 20 years old and upward to have the oversight of the work on the house of the Lord. And Jeshua with his sons and his kin, and Kadmiel and his sons, Benui and Hodaviah, along with the sons of Henadad, the Levites, their sons and kin, together took charge of the workers in the house of God. So the only thing that really stands out to me there is that it's the Levites who are the ones who are in charge of working on the temple, the mm-hmm. Levites, the holy tribe, who are responsible for the holy things.
Yep.
So they're working on the temple, the foundation of the temple. That's what we're up to right now. Yeah?
Yeah. Yep.
So picking up then in verse 10, when the builders laid the foundations of the temple of the Lord, the priests in their vestments were stationed to praise the Lord with trumpets, and the Levites, the son of Asaph, with cymbals, according to the directions of King David of Israel. And they sang responsively, praising and giving thanks to the Lord. For he is good, for his steadfast love endures forever toward Israel.
So I picture this, you know, beautiful festive gathering. It's got trumpets and cymbals and, you know, they're singing this phrase that is, you know, known from the Psalms. And we do get mention here of King David of Israel, who is, you know, a musician and certainly liked a good party. So
the depiction of David's role in the construction of the first temple is very different in First and Second Chronicles than it is in First and Second Samuel and Kings.
Mm.
And so Chronicles, David doesn't construct the temple because that's Solomon's job, but he mm-hmm. does everything but, right? He like draws out all the plans and like tells Solomon how to do it, all the things. And so Ezra and Nehemiah have a close relation to First and Second Chronicles. So I think that's what's happening here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're right.
And so I mean, so it's interesting that what essentially what this is saying is that when they laid out the second temple, they did it according to the plans that David had left for Solomon for the first temple. And so they really are trying to like recreate the thing exactly as it's supposed to be and as it was before the Babylonian incursion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there's this this responsive singing that's taking place. And what they're singing is, "For he is good, for his steadfast love endures forever toward Israel." Thoughts about that responsive reading there?
I mean, the phrase is in multiple psalms.
Mm-hmm.
And according to Chronicles, this phrase became prominent in the liturgy in the Second Temple. So I feel like this is giving us a little window into the developing liturgy for this new era.
Yeah. I was thinking about that, you know, if you envision the scene, right? The people are they're in the ruins of a temple. They've got a foundation of a new temple up. They've got an altar that has been kind of propped back up. You know, like this thing's kind of makeshift.
Yeah.
And here is the specificity of God's steadfast love endures for Israel. Seems really important here to say, when you look around you, it may seem like you're just kind of piecing this thing together, but God's love is mm-hmm. here and present now and is everlasting. That specificity seems urgent to me in this moment.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that makes a lot of sense. Like God's love is here specifically for you specifically, like, yeah, to sort of have that pointedness to it.
Yeah. So when the people hear this call and response, then in second half of verse 11, all the people responded with a great shout when they praised the Lord, because the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid. And so we've got the temple, the foundation is ready to go, we've restarted, and the people are, at least in this first moment, kind of the people are jubilant, shouting and praising God.
Mm-hmm.
But then in verse 12, but many of the priests and Levites and heads of families, old people who had seen the first house on its foundation, wept with a loud voice when they saw this house, though many shouted aloud for joy, so that the people could not distinguish the sound of the joyful shout from the sound of the people's weeping, for the people shouted so loudly that the sound was heard far away. Now that is fascinating to me. Like, I love that little detail of the text, and I feel like there's so much one could unpack there.
These couple of verses, I think, are just exquisite.
Yeah.
This idea of like the old folks who had been there for the first temple and had survived the exile and are now coming back to this place of their trauma at the same time that this new temple is sort of being born, and the people are being told, like, everything is the same as it was. We're doing everything the same as it was. Like, this is all, this is all one continuous line, and we're just sort of turning back the clock to how it was. But you can't ever turn back the clock to how it was, right? And I mean, the people who were there and experienced the first temple and all that happened since the time of its destruction, I love? I don't know if that's the right word. I love that the text includes this detail in here, that it is this joyous moment, and this is all as it should be. You know, there's no hint in the text that they were doing anything wrong or shouldn't have been doing this. This is all good. This should be happening. And it does not annul the agony of the loss of the first temple.
I mean, I think that what you're saying about the like people who remember the old structure and the destruction and the pain of that experience and the ambiguity of seeing it reconstructed. And I really love that complexity of emotions that you're thinking about. And this may be also in what you're saying, but I feel like there is some sense, presumably, of disappointment from people who had seen the first one. So it's not just remembering the things that they've been through, but like, they had seen the glory of the Solomonic temple, and now there's this little like platform with a propped up mm-hmm. altar on it, and they've been working all this time, and it's just this little thing that bears no comparison really to the mm-hmm. thing that came before. And I feel like there had to be some kind of disappointment, like, we saw it in its glory, and this is not that. So mm-hmm. you youngsters who are celebrating this thing, like, you haven't really seen what it's supposed to look like. The prophet Haggai, who's writing kind of at the same time as Ezra, like set in the same time, has, in chapter 2 of Haggai, verse 2, or verse 3, he says, "Who is left among you that saw this house in its former glory?" That is the temple. "How does it look to you now? Is it not in your sight as nothing?" And so I don't want to just import Haggai directly into Ezra, but I think there's something that both of these texts are remembering, this sense of like, this new thing that we have is not at all like the old thing, and it's pretty disappointing to us.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this excitement, and there's also disappointment. There's joy, and there's sorrow, and these things are all just kind of stacking up on each other, and mm-hmm. it's indiscernible.
Yeah, it makes me think, too, of this sort of, you know, I'm imagining the sense of permanence and stability and, like, omnipotence sort of that was associated with the first temple, you know, and this sort of puncture in that the edifice of like the temple can't be your North Star. Like the temple went away.
Yeah.
We're rebuilding it, but it's going to be different now. Like your relationship to it is going to be different now.
Yeah. As you start to think about that and think about where this text connects to things going on in modern day, connects to you and your community, where do you go in terms of the interpretation for contemporary life?
So one of the things I've been thinking a lot about with Ezra is Ezra's strong interest in bringing tradition back and sort of connecting to tradition, and not why he wants to do that. I mean, I know why he wants to do that in terms of the biblical text, but sort of what it is for the human experience to feel that we are connecting to ancient tradition and how that gives us some sort of both a sort of like it really like roots you in something and gives you sort of a sense of connection to something much bigger than yourself. And I want to say in some ways, like it really changes your perception of time. Like if you feel connected to something that existed generations ago and that will exist generations in the future, there's sort of a blurring of the present moment into the past and the future that I think can be quite lovely. Mm. I guess this text has me thinking about ritual.
Yes.
And sort of ritual and human connection to time or timelessness.
Yeah.
And how ritual helps us cross over generations.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's hard to do, but I think that's one of the roles of ritual in my tradition, at least.
That's lovely. And so when you're thinking then about the restarting of the sacrificial calendar, like we've talked about in terms of like restarting, reorienting time and reconnecting the relationship to God, but you just kind of introduce this idea that's also connecting you to previous generations of the community.
Mm-hmm.
But in the time of Advent, to remember that Advent is a season that has oriented Christians for millennia now, mm-hmm. And so to feel that connection across time, that's a real gift, I think, of a more ritually astute tradition like yours to a tradition like ours.
I think especially in vulnerable times, yeah, where there's sort of nothing in your maybe immediate present that feels super solid. Yeah, ritual connections across time can sort of do that. And I think that's a great point relating to Advent and this sort of, you know, vulnerability of the darkness of December and the period of waiting.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a really beautiful connection. Mm-hmm. What about you?
Well, where I go with this text, I mean, this is very specific to my own kind of religious tradition, but as a Presbyterian, you know, we have a memory of a time about 50 years ago when we were kind of a big and culturally significant group. And along with other mainline traditions in the U.S., we have lost a lot of our significance and a lot of our membership over the last 50 years. So this text with this kind of sense of trying to remember and recreate the thing that was there before is kind of making me think about that and what it means to be a mainline Christian in 2019 when we have been disestablished and decentered in the culture in a lot of ways. So this text is, I mean, it's making me think of a lot of different kinds of thoughts about that. But one of them is what we started with way back at the beginning about kind of the first thing is just to start doing the things again, right? And don't worry about whether the altar is a nice altar or whether the building is a nice building.
Right.
But we just do the best we can with what we have in the moment. So that was really striking me. And then the very last thing that we talked about the intermingling of the joy and the sorrow, and thinking generationally in my own tradition, there are some good things that have come out of the disestablishment and the decentering of the church and kind of a reinvention. We're learning how to reinvent ourselves in ways that are more inclusive and ways that are less patriarchal and ways that are less heteronormative. We're learning how to do all of those things. And so there is kind of an exciting future that seems possible, about which a lot of people want to celebrate. And at the same time, there is a generation that still remembers the beautiful things of the past and is sad that it is no longer the way things are. And sometimes in my tradition, there is a fight between these two groups about you shouldn't be excited, you should be sad that we're not the way we were, or the other way around, like you shouldn't be sad about the past, but excited about the future. And this text is saying, yeah, I mean, both of those things are true, and both of those experiences are real, and the intermingling of the joy and the sorrow doesn't have to be in tension. We don't have to try to pull them apart, but let the people who are excited be excited, and let the people who are sorrowful be sorrowful, and maybe those people are the same people sometimes. The thing is that is for the community to be together doing this thing and to know that the future is not the past. The future is yet to come, but it remembers the past, and to honor that tradition while yet realizing that it's going to take form in new ways. That seems really urgently important to my context. And in a season of Advent where, you know, for Advent for us is sort of, you know, we're welcoming the Christ child into the world, and kind of the belief about that is the world can't be the same for us, you know, on December 26th as it is on December 24th, and we reenact that every year. And so reminding ourselves that the world can't be the same and living into the new promise the best we can with what we've got, even if we're scared, that seems really valuable in this moment.
That's really beautiful. Is it true that next week we are moving into the New Testament?
Yeah, so next week we're moving into the Gospel of Luke, Zechariah's song in Luke chapter 1 verses, I don't know, it's the new narrative lectionary is 5 through 13, 14 through 25 in brackets, and 57 through 80, which is a weird, like you don't see very many 80s, do you?
No.
I can tell from your face that you haven't seen that very often.
Verse 80.
So yeah, so I don't know how we're going to parse out that chapter, but we're going to be in Luke chapter 1 next time. Amy, it's been really good talking to you today.
You too. Y'all have a good week.
See you next time.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of NLDR, the Narrative Lectionary Podcast for People on the Go. We'll be back here next week as we begin our foray into the New Testament with the story of Elizabeth and Zechariah and the miraculous birth of John the Baptist. We'll see you then.